This is an interview with Raphael Cormack on 4 September 2020. Thank you for agreeing to participate in this research and agreeing to spend some time with us. So our questions start off with looking at tragedy as understood as the actual plays themselves as originally written in, well, ancient tragedy in the sense, in the 5th century kind of era, and how these have been picked up in particularly African contexts. And here we're specifically thinking about Egypt as specifically. So you had a number of productions that you were particularly interested in. Can you just say what the title of the production was?
So one production that we can talk about, which I believe to be the first production of a classical Greek tragedy in Egypt, is the 1912 George Abiad's version of Oedipus Tyrannus. So in the 19th century and early 20th century, there had been a number of classical productions put on, but they were all, I believe, based on French, Racine and sort of French neoclassical reworkings of classical plays. So Racine, and there was Voltaire and Oedipus and this kind of thing. But in 1912, this actor, George Abiad, who was actually of sort of Lebanese heritage, who'd come to Egypt, had been sent by the Khedive of Egypt to Paris to study theatre, where he sort of, he trained with Eugène Sylvain, a French actor, the Comédie Française. There's some speculation over whether he'd actually been to the Comédie Française to train, but I think he hadn't, the Conservatoire. Anyway, he comes back in 1912 to put on, to sort of build as this huge landmark production, the first Arabic translation of Sophocles' Oedipus. He does it alongside a few other plays, including an Arabic translation of Othello. It's performed at the main opera house to a kind of audience of notables. So the sort of ruler of Egypt is there among several other politicians and kind of important people from the region. And there, so it's quite interesting because the was heavily involved in kind of singing. So the songs were one of the most important parts of the theatre, and one of the most famous actor kind of producers was this man called Salama Hegazi, who in every play he wrote, he performed, would put in these big sort of musical numbers. And he wrote songs for the play. George Abiad, this sort of French-trained actor, performed the main role of Oedipus, and it was billed as this huge event. To kind of, if you want, I can talk a little bit more about the reception.
Can we just hold off on the reception for the moment? So, do you know any of the other performers, the names of the other performers that were involved in the production?
I don't have them at my fingertips now. I think Milia Diane played for this Jocasta. So it might have been Mariam Sumart. I can send them to you later because I'm pretty sure I can get access to the article that goes through the list of performers.
Okay. And it was performed, it's an Arabic translation, so it was performed in Arabic.
An Arabic translation done by a writer called Farah Antoun, who is also quite famous as a newspaper kind of journal editor, novelist, kind of political thinker, who's sort of early Arab socialist. Done from translated probably from a French text, not from the Greek itself, but in Arabic.
And do you think there was a particular kind of sense that this was an event in the sense of that this was being done in Arabic and not in say English or French, as the case may be?
Yeah, definitely. There is a story which is probably apocryphal that the great nationalist Egyptian leader is called Saad Zaghloul, who in a few years after this kind of led a revolution against the British.
Mm.
But he was education minister, and there's kind of a story that Saad Zaghloul himself went to George Abiad and said, "You really need to be performing in Arabic. You know, we know you can do it in French, but it's going to be good for the country if people can do it in Arabic." But that is probably slightly exaggerated. But there are articles in French newspapers interviewing George Abiad in which he specifically says, "I want to come home and do this in Arabic."
So it's part of a kind of nationalistic agenda to build up the concept of an Egyptian national culture and in the modern sense.
Yeah, I mean, it could certainly be read that way.
Yeah. And do you have a sense why this particular Greek tragedy? Do you think he chose Oedipus for a particular reason?
This is slightly speculation. I mean, we don't have him explaining why he chose it. I think he probably did it because he was influenced by Mounet Sully's Oedipus, which was big in the early 20th century in Paris, where he was.
Mm.
So that was sort of one of the big plays going around. And there are pictures of the performance in which his dress is clearly influenced by that Oedipus.
So do you think there's a kind of tension between the concept of the staging, let's say, and the choice of Arabic? I mean, on the one hand, the choice of Arabic might be pointing towards a kind of more political agenda, but it sounds like the production might have followed very much what you might have seen in a French classical
theater. Yeah, and I mean, and that is one of the big tensions of Arabic cultural production in this period, the sort of 1910s, 20s, 30s.
Mm.
It's often more implicit than explicit. More in the 50s and 60s, it becomes more of an explicit concern. Mm. But in this period, there's this tension between whether to sort of follow Europe or whether to tread a sort of specifically Egyptian path. People are constantly debating it and never quite figure out the answer. In the case of this play, the tension is perhaps more obvious than others, because a lot of the times people say they are following Europe. Some of the reviews say, oh, we're with this play, we're kind of catching up to Europe.
Mm.
But they're also trying to sort of make it a specifically Egyptian, and kind of as we've already discussed, has a sort of nationalist kind of reasoning behind it. But that tension is there in so much of this stuff in this period.
And do you think, and in terms of like design elements and that, do you have sense from the pictures of what you think, you feel like it was very influenced by the production that he would have seen in France?
That's where I said there are not that many pictures survive of that. I mean, of that original production, no pictures probably survived, but he did keep doing this play well into the 1940s.
Oh.
So some pictures of those productions do survive. And clearly his costume is based on Mounet Sully. It's almost one for one.
So if you can we go back to the music thing, which you said was in, can you speak a little bit more about, do you feel like how do you think the music operated within the production, and do you think it was like an essential addition, or do you to the tragic conception, or do you think it was more like pulling away from that in an attempt to make it more popular or accessible in some kind of way?
Well, I mean, the obvious attempt to kind of, the obvious parallel would be the Greek chorus, obviously. And they're not specifically trying to engage with the Greek chorus. I mean, the songs aren't translations or even kind of riffs on the choral verses in the play. They're written separately normally for most plays and for this play too. So they tend to come, I mean, I suppose this is as the Greek chorus, they come in roughly the same place and at moments of sort of these high tension.
Mm.
But they are, one, I think yes, they're made to make the plays more popular with the general audience. I think these audiences would have demanded it.
Mm.
There's a story, one of these stories about a production of Hamlet being put on by Selema Hegazi, who is the same guy who wrote the songs for this play, and there were no songs in that production of Hamlet. And at the end, the audience complains and starts chanting, "We need another act. You're not going to give us any songs." And songs would often be released on record, songs.
Mm. So
a large part of the justification. So a large part of the justification would be to appeal to the audience, but how they work within the play itself, I suppose, is more interesting, and particularly within this, within the context of a Greek tragedy, where there are places for songs to be. A complicated issue. Probably moments of high tension. The one thing that they do in relation to our previous discussion is they give a much more kind of Egyptian element. So although the play itself is kind of based on this text by Sophocles via the French, these songs were made up by Selema Hegazi, written by him, and much more in the local style. And others have written on this, and I forget the person who wrote the article, but other songs in relation to Romeo and Juliet, a lot of the songs that were added to that play are very much within a kind of Arabic love elegy style. So they bring much more of the kind of local context into
and
the play.
Call me, okay.
If we can shift to the reception then, how was it received, and was it very class bound? So I mean, it happening at the Opera House, was it very much an elite event?
Yes, essentially yes, and it was. Although, as I said before, he keeps putting this play on for 30 years after, or more even, after the first production, it never quite becomes a popular hit. It's always more seen by sort of, you know, upper class, more elite, perhaps sort of also, you know, bourgeois intellectuals, as a great moment of, you know, Arabic literature. We're putting Oedipus on in Arabic. This is, you know, at the time they say, oh, this is finally sort of proper theatre, real serious theatre being put on. But it never really captures the popular imagination. I mean, it runs for a little bit. He sometimes tries, every couple of years, he puts on another version, but it doesn't ever seem to be his most in-demand play.
Mm. And in different venues?
In different venues, yeah, yeah. So in George Abiad himself, he built his own theatre in the late 1910s, early 1920s, which doesn't last that long. And he puts it on there. There's in the 40s, there's a version of this play is broadcast on the radio, which actually is still on YouTube to listen to. And some other venues, but yeah, and the theatre at the time was very kind of slapdash. You'd put on a play wherever you had the chance to put it on. If you could get the money together, you'd put it on there. He just happened to be, for this performance, was sponsored by the ruling Khedive, so he had a good source of money for that.
But that changed. So that was 1912, right? It was still a British colony, or so, or whatever you... whatever the political thing was, but it was under the control of Britain. But by the time, 1922, was it that mm-hmm. Egypt becomes kind of independent? And in that post 22 period, if he's redoing the production, mm-hmm. does it change at all?
No, and in that period, it doesn't get put on that much. I mean, that in the 20s and 30s, it's not. He tries to push it a lot in the 10s, and then it doesn't go. The structure of who pays the theatre does change a little bit. By the 1930s, the Egyptian government are paying for some theatre, but not that much. And it's a constant complaint on the part of actors that the new government is not funding Arabic theatre enough.
Mm. Okay. So, but you said it went on as late as 1944.
It does, but sporadically. So there is an attempt again in the 1940s to put on this script, but not with George Aviad, by Taha Hussein, who is a very important person in the in the reception of Greek tragedy, who we could mention, but I don't know if you want to get into that.
Yeah, please go ahead.
He trained at Cairo University and then did a PhD in the Sorbonne. He comes back to Egypt at the beginning of the 1920s and starts, as well as teaching, the end of the 1910s, but as well as teaching classics, starts translating a lot of Greek tragedy into Arabic, intended not specifically for performance, although some of the scripts are performed. He starts translating Sophocles and also Aristotle. Sorry, just, hello? Starts translating a lot of these, and really pushing the Greek heritage as part of Egyptian heritage too. And he really gets stuck into these debates that we were talking about earlier, about whether it's European, whether it's kind of a part of Egyptian heritage, how, to what extent can Egyptians claim Greek tragedy as their own. He's probably the first person to really open these up.
And what was his opinion?
It's inconsistent, but broadly that Egypt was part of a kind of Eastern Mediterranean culture. Mm. I don't think he doesn't use that specific term. And that this history is as much theirs to claim as it is anyone else's to claim. But he sometimes gets tangled up in knots a little bit.
So he's seeing it not as like reception of some kind of foreign body of work, but essentially part of the broader classical heritage that Egyptians can claim.
He's not always consistent, but either Egyptians can claim as part of their own, which sometimes he specifically says. For instance, he does a translation of Aristotle's Constitution of the Athenians, in which he notes that the papyrus itself was discovered in Egypt, it's kind of theirs. Other times he more sees Greece as this kind of universal, global culture.
Okay.
That's open to anyone. But so he writes about this kind of topic for 30 or 40 years, and so his views shift. But not only does he see this as something that Egyptians can definitely claim, but he's also extremely committed to kind of Arabic language culture and Arabic heritage too. So he really juggles these issues, and also does a huge amount of the translations, which people still today consider to be the best translations of a lot of these tragic texts.
Okay, you spoke about a second production that a later production of Oedipus that you wanted to talk about. What is that?
So this is a production of Ali Selim's comedy of Oedipus, or otherwise known as You're the One Who Killed the Beast, which is from 1970. And then this kind of, talking about this production can bring us into the much more sort of post 1952 revolution sort of Nasserist conceptions of what Greek tragedy can be. And so this one, it was a script. The basic story is a script written by this sort of comic playwright Ali Salem in the late 60s. He had been extremely influenced by a book by Emmanuel Velikovsky called Oedipus and Akhenaten, which had been written in, I forget when, I think it might have been the 40s or 50s, but had been translated into Arabic in the 60s. And he had read that, and the basic argument in that is that Oedipus was in fact Egyptian. I think the Oedipus was based, the myth of Oedipus is based on the actual pharaoh, Akhenaten. So he, Ali Salem, takes that up and slightly ironically, and then sets the whole myth of Oedipus. He reworks it, sets it in the Egyptian Thebes, and turns it much more into a sort of comic set. Again, it's interestingly, it's musical numbers are a big part of it, as.
You're just disappearing for a moment.
He turns it both into a sort of comic reworking of Oedipus and a critique of kind of the Nasserist
So this one is, this one has a kind of underlying political kind of thing going on.
Yeah, both in terms of this sort of a slightly exaggerated for comic effect, nationalist political critiques about NASA. Am I cutting out?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Carry on. I can hear you now.
Okay, yeah. Shall I repeat what I just said?
Yeah, yeah. Nationalist critiques of NASA. What did you, something like that?
Yeah. Oh, well, so it's political in two ways. One, in that it's a kind of comically exaggerated nationalist reappropriation of the Oedipus story for Egypt. But also, there are specific political comments made about both NASA and also sort of his secret police and the people's support for him, which is kind of, which the play sees as sort of slightly a naive, misguided character in certain terms. I mean, people have tried to see the ancient Greek or ancient Egyptian setting as a way to hide these messages, but I think it's A, pretty obvious, B, they also, you know, the play makes jokes inside the play itself about people using poetry to try and code political messages.
And have you seen images from those, from that production? I mean, it's more recent, yeah.
So yeah, there are images of that production that were in the local press, and the director in his Arabic memoirs, which were released in Egypt in, I think, March in 90s, 2000s, reproduces a lot of pictures from that. From that production, the it's slightly wild, sort of semi-ancient Egyptian, semi-modern kind of mishmash. So halfway through the play, one of the conceits is Oedipus, who is in control of Thebes, manages to modernize the country and take it forward 2,000 years. I forget what it says, and so halfway through the play, all this modern technology starts appearing, you know, radios and TV shows and things like that. So that's a Tiresias character who people said looked like one of the Beatles. It was also an English translation of the play was performed in 2015, it could be, yeah, in the 2010s in London, in the Unicorn Pub.
By who? Who did that?
I'm blanking on his name now, an Egyptian director.
Yeah. Based in the UK, or he came to the UK to do it?
Based in the UK.
Okay.
I'm going to see if I can find the details of that. Yeah. In 2013, El Alfi, he's called. The El Alfi Theatre Company, ELALFY.
Yeah. And you say, and you said there was music involved in this one as well.
Yeah. And according to the writer, it actually all started with an idea for a song, which is. Okay.
And did you have a sense of what kind of music that was?
Sort of light, reasonably comic music of the.
Of the 19th.
Nice little ditties.
Okay. So it wasn't like it suddenly sprung into rock musicals or anything like that in the 1970s?
No. No.
Okay. Okay, so are there any other particular productions of any of these Greek tragedies that you want to just point to briefly before we move on?
So where you can really start to get in good, solid information and nice pictures and easily accessible reviews of productions, the cult sort of comes in the 1960s, and there is quite a big burst of classical plays put on in the 1960s. Mm. So there's another translator called Louis Awad, who was the student of Taha Hussein, who we mentioned earlier, the sort of 1920s-30s dean of Arabic literature. He translated Aeschylus, Agamemnon Choriphoroi, into Arabic, and a few of those productions were put on in Cairo. One of them using the Greek director Takis Mouzenidis.
Mm-hmm.
He put on the Agamemnon Choriphoroi in the National Theatre, big production, and that of which pictures survive in. Actually, I gave some magazines to the AGPRD. Library, which have pictures of that production.
Okay,
and it was a big deal at the time, and there were several kind of in the 60s, the Nasserist government really tried to promote theater. I mean, there was a really big theater boom at the time. Not only by there were people sponsoring it, but also lots of new writers coming in, influences from. Brecht was particularly big.
Mm.
There's lots of kind of this new wave of theatre. And so there's two sort of main theatres where classical plays were put on. One is the big National Theatre, where the Takis Mouzenidis version of Aeschylus was put on. And the other was called the Pocket Theatre, which had more kind of experimental plays, smaller audiences, slightly more higher-minded, and that is where Louis Howard Agamemnon was put on to a smaller crowd.
Mm.
There are other things going on. With there was, as you said before, there's an Antigone.
Mm.
There's much more engagement with classical players and much more easily accessible in the sort of 50s to 60s period, because theatre becomes this real one of the sort of big centerpieces of sort of Egyptian cultural production at the time.
And with a specifically nationalistic agenda. I mean, Nasser is putting money into the arts because he thinks the arts are going to push a particular ideology or a particular government policy of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not quite. I mean, maybe it's not quite so simple as that, but essentially, yes. And, you know, it's just sort of specifically nationalistic for the kind of, it's the great glory of Nasser's regime to be able to put on these great plays. A lot of the theatre, you know, a lot of the playwrights were arrested and sort of put in prison. So it's not quite as, not quite as kind of one-to-one as that. So one of the, there's all the loads of stories. I think Alfred Farag, one of the big playwrights who wrote his greatest play on cigarette papers in prison, and all the prisoners get together and do a performance of it, which he claims is the best performance of it that was ever done. I think that's Suleiman al-Halabi, but there's a book on Alfred Farag by by Dina Amin that goes into, you know, that story.
So there seems to be, if there's more money in happening, more productions happening, but also seemingly quite a lot of government clampdown on dissident voices in some ways.
I should mention, sorry, before we got the Comedy of Oedipus itself was stopped after a few performances.
Okay.
Because it was deemed to be a bit dodgy politically.
but is that by you think that's by design, in the sense that the director wants it to be that, or more that it's just a skittish kind of government seeing ghosts behind every or in every cupboard or every, you know what I mean?
I mean, it is definitely critical of, I mean, the play Comedy of Oedipus is definitely critical of the whole Egyptian political system. It tries to not be critical of Nasser himself. So, I mean, as a lot of people were doing at the time, sort of one argument is, oh, Nasser is trying to do this great job, but the whole system that has been built around him is corrupt or doesn't quite work. The Comedy of Oedipus play is critical of Nasserism, which seems to be sticks to that line too. So the Oedipus character, if he is Nasser, is trying to do this great job, but his chief of police is a bad guy or this stuff. So maybe they thought they were treading sort of that line and that it would be okay. Or maybe they just, it was sort of slightly, it was wanting to be seen as critical.
So, and you spoke earlier about the Hakim version play that was not performed, but written as theatre of the mind. You want to just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so we've talked about a play from 1912, and now we've talked about a play from 1970, and political science. Colonial government, essentially. In 1912, the play that we talked about was essentially under a British colonial government, and the 1970 play is the end, really, of the sort of post-colonial Nasser regime. So those are two big moments in Egyptian theatre, but there were, in the 1940s, there were a large number of versions of Oedipus Rex, which is the play I know most about. So in 1949, which the political situation at that point is post-Second World War. Again, as we said, Egypt is officially independent in 1922, but the British still maintain a lot of control in the Suez Canal, for one, and also more nebulously in government. During the Second World War, the British had really moved in and sort of forced the nominally independent Egyptian government to toe the war line. in the aftermath, there's this huge sort of political chaos in the late 1940s and early 1950s, which essentially leads to the revolution in 52. But in this period of sort of the rise of importance of the Muslim Brotherhood for a while, and then the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood is assassinated. Also, prime ministers are assassinated. There's a lot of political assassination going on at the time. And it's in this kind of moment that two versions of Oedipus are produced, are written, in fact, though not specifically for production. And I think neither of them were produced in any significant manner. I mean, so there's Tawfiq El Hakim does a version of Oedipus in which he sort of rewrites it for an Egyptian audience, including a long introduction about how one can rewrite Greek tragedy as what he calls himself as an Easterner, and what the kind of issues at play there are, which we'll talk about in a second. But I'll just mention briefly also, there's another version of Oedipus written by Ali Ahmed Bakatir, who is sort of Yemeni origin but has moved to Egypt in the 20s and 30s, probably loosely affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, but that's again slightly unclear. That is a version of Oedipus in which basically he calls the powers of Thebes, as it was, corrupt. So, you know, the temple powers are all corrupt and they're taking money. And Tiresias is a sort of proto-Islamic almost prophet who guides Oedipus towards this sort of new way of thinking about the world, which is essentially Islamic. And then and the play ends actually with Oedipus leaving the city, but sort of having instituted a sort of a new world, being on the edge of being born. So they're both interesting engagements with Oedipus done at this extremely tense political time in Egypt, and both of them engaging with specifics of what it is to be Egyptian at this time, or what it might be.
And they were not produced, do you think, because of the political tension?
I think Ali Ahmed Bakatir's one, I think, can be read as sort of direct comment on all this political tension. Perhaps some kind of support for the Muslim Brotherhood that might be overreaching, but at least it's a comment on the corruption of the late 1940s political system. Tawfiq El Hakim, less so, although there a lot of that political stuff is kind of in there, but it's not foregrounded.
So I just want to shift a little bit here, and maybe you can answer this and maybe you can't, but as I understand it, there's this tension, which is also a tension that we have here in South Africa, where you are of the continent but not as such. So as you describe Al Hakim is writing about himself as an Easterner, right? So he's locating himself or orientating himself very specifically to the Middle East or that kind of area. And he's saying, this is how I would approach doing a Greek tragedy. That's what I'm understanding from you. As such a person, what was there this other pressure to, I mean, there comes that period in the like 1960s where in terms of African politics, there's a strong feeling to include the Maghreb region in the Pan-African kind of context. Whereas, you know, there were people who were saying, no, well, they don't have anything to do with Africa. Is there any sense in which there is a kind of sense of an African heritage at all in any of the theatrical production that you came across? Or is it all orientated away from the continent towards this Mediterranean culture or this Arabic culture?
My sense is the latter, that people don't really have a sense of Egypt in these productions, at least. They don't try and have a sense of Egypt as a kind of African nation dealing with Greek tragedy. To talk a little bit more about that, I would say before 1950, basically, there's very little sense of Egypt as an African nation sort of at all. I don't know if you've read Eve Trout Powell's Different Shade of Colonialism. She talks a lot about Egypt's relationship with Sudan as a kind of sort of quasi-colonial relationship. Well, you know, sort of Egypt is colonized by Britain, and then in turn Egypt sort of replays a lot of those dynamics on Sudan. That's pre-1950. I think you'd be hard pressed. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. You'd be hard pressed to find people who would challenge sort of that idea and say, no, Egypt is an African country. There's this famous quote from the Khedive Ismail in the late 19th century, in which he says, Egypt is no longer part of Africa, we've become European.
European.
Yeah, part of Europe. After the 1950s, you know, after NAFTA, then it becomes more complicated, because NAFTA does have this big, or at least, you know, considerable, it might not be its central focus, but this idea of becoming more part of Africa and all the, you know, the third world more generally. He invites, you know, lots of kind of resistance, African resistance leaders, as it were. I mean, so famously, Kwame Nkrumah marries an Egyptian. I think Lumumba's kids spend some time in Egypt. He, you know, NAFTA tries to bring all of these sort of like big post-colonial leaders into Egypt, enter into their orbit. Again, there's like, I mean, I have not looked into that much detail about this. It's not, there are some perhaps neo-colonial aspects to that too. You know, it's unclear whether or not NASA sees them as partners or as kind of juniors that he can lead, but I mean, I don't know so much about that. So you would expect maybe that to show up in some of these theatrical adaptations, but I haven't seen it.
Okay, and when you were doing your research, when was that particularly? In the 20...
I started research on this project in around 2010, 2011. I actually started by looking at Tawfiq el-Hakim, who is the man who did the 1949 Oedipus, trying to make it Eastern. He did a number of plays which were based on the Electra myth, and he had sort of some interesting takes on that, which I'm happy to talk about. And then I moved on to Oedipus. The main focus of what I look at is from the late 19th century and sort of the 1960s. It doesn't go much beyond that.
So, but what I was trying to move
speak
towards,
to other people.
What I was trying to move towards was, did you spend time in Cairo over this period? Did you?
Yeah.
So, in the 2010 and onwards period that you were there, were you aware of productions going on at the time? Did you see any, or did you that you personally?
I saw one production of Antigone in the Gomorrah Theatre, which must have been, I'm guessing it's 2015, around that time. That was part of a theatre festival. That was an interesting production. I can try and find later exactly who was involved in it. It was curiously quite like the early 20th century or like previous Egyptian productions of Greek tragedy. It added songs. It added a sort of a comic duo. There was this sort of comic gods who were sort of did a bit of slapstick humor. And it ends in a sort of a kind of happy ending in which Antigone and her lover, instead of going into the cave to be buried, to sort of share a final kiss scene at the end.
So, and who was it? What kind of company was putting it on, or was it?
It was part of a theatre festival in which there must have been 30 or so plays. I mean, the big theatre festival. It seemed like a young kind of upcoming company. I'd have to look into it to figure out who it was.
Okay.
Another thing that I did see was a number of plays by El Warsha Theatre Troupe. And talked a little bit about to Hassan Gretli, who leads that. They didn't do specifically any Greek tragedy, but what they do is they're very interested in old Arabic sort of folk tales and oral stories and siras. And when I was talking to Hassan al-Gharatli, he noted at least some of the similarities in the structure of these tales to Greek myth. And I think that's a reasonably common view amongst theater producers in general. People like to make these connections between older myths, and in this case, Egyptian sort of myths and folk tales and Greek myths. Am I still going?
Yeah. So that's an interesting thing for me. Do you think that some of the attraction of these plays might be also informal, as opposed to in terms of form, rather than in terms of only the content, or saying this is our heritage as well, or any of those kinds of sentiments, that there is something about the nature of Greek theatre, the choral aspects, maybe the connection to myth, these kinds of things that might have been maybe even a ritual thing that maybe might be recognizable or to an Egyptian audience or theatre makers.
Yes, I think Hassan al-Gharatli saw some of that. I would say one thing I looked at in the course of my research, which is not a play but might speak to this, is a 1904 translation of the Iliad. Very interesting book done by a sort of Ottoman diplomat, Lebanese, but who was based in Cairo. And he was looking at epic as a form rather than specifically tragedy. He says sort of in the introduction, at first he saw that Arabic had no epic, so he wanted to translate some of these great epics, like whatever, to give similar to Milton or Virgil, so he went back to Homer. But then later on in the introduction, he goes on to say that he saw a lot of similarities between this world and the way the stories are put together and the pre-Islamic and sort of surely post-Islamic epic tradition, which is called Sira, S-I-R-A, which is the Sira tradition is something that El Warsha and Hassan Gharatli are also influenced by. So I think there's definitely people from 1904 till now have seen the connection between Arabic, what is called Arabian epic or folk tale or whatever exactly you want to call it, and both the form of Greek literature and also the environment in which it kind of grew up in. That's something, for instance, that the translator of the Iliad, Suleiman al-Bustani, talks about. He sees the world of Greek epic and the world of Arabic epic to be comparable.
And I mean, it's interesting because Fiona McIntosh from that, who runs the APG, or the she's written a book recently on epic and the epic tradition, and argues that she thinks the distinctions between genres like epic and tragedy were far less rigid than has been made out since, well, in the reading of Aristotle, which makes the line very hard between them. Yeah. And that's interesting to me a lot, because I think that's true here as well. I know that a colleague of mine here is working on a production at the moment based on the Odyssey, and he's finding a very strong relationship exactly with what you're saying. He's like reading the Odyssey and saying, this feels like the world of Xhosa storytelling, mm-hmm. and in a kind of Southern African, you know, motif or paradigm. So I think that's an interesting thing, the way that I'm just interested to know whether it's all about, whether the attraction to these plays is all about content, or whether there is something mm-hmm. about the nature of the kind of dramaturgical world, if you like, or environment, or and the aesthetics employed that somehow are easily relatable to audiences in various parts of the continent.
I think that there's definitely something to that. I will just read a sort of, if we want to argue against that, there's a very interesting a set of articles written in the 1960s by this guy, Yusuf Idris, who was a big short story writer, he's known as, but also a playwright and general journalist. It's called Towards an Egyptian Theatre, published in 1964. Is there truly an Egyptian theatre? Does it really exist? And where is it hiding if it does exist?
Mm.
He goes into the theatre.
Are you breaking up again?
World.
So you broke
yeah,
up?
So in this... Hello? Can you hear
me
now?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, great. So in this collection of articles, he goes into ideas about the tragic and its relation to Egyptian theatre specifically. And this is the time in which a lot of folk traditions are sort of trying to be revived, and people are trying to sort of post-colonial time, which is sort of similar in lots of post-colonial countries, in which people are trying to go back to argue sort of pre-colonial, I don't think he specifically says pre-colonial, but like pre-colonial forms, and figure out how they work. And he goes into specifically Egyptian tragic heroes. I'm looking now for the quote. So here we go. Idris, I'm just reading a translation of my own that I put in my thesis in the play, but he says, taking Oedipus kind of as an example, he says, nothing confirms the fundamental difference between Egyptian theatre and Greek theatre, he says, brackets, from that European theatre, like our understanding of tragedy as the people. He goes on to say, Greek tragedy is a kind of theatre which the Greek wanted to portray the heroism as man, as he resists or fights his fate, on the assumption that the hero is some victim, or that some divine fate has been written for him, that he will kill his father, for example, and marry his mother. That's his quote on Greek tragedy, and then he compares it to what he sees as the Egyptian tragic hero, which he says, our tragic hero here in Egypt, in the Arab world, or in the East in general, is different. He's not the victim of some cruel or arbitrary fate. The hero here is a true hero, not for the heroic deeds that he does, but because he has his own fate in his hands and can guide his own life. So I just thought that's an interesting engagement with Greek tragedy as an Egyptian, extremely kind of post-colonial, not only in his attempt to find a sort of Egyptian form of tragedy, but also in this assertion that Egyptian heroes will guide their own fate, and all of this very kind of like had the hope of the new post-colonial world in his interpretation of tragedy.
Mm-hmm. And do you think people would think the same today?
I doubt it.
Yeah. Okay. And so just to end off, can we just come back to this question of reception? This whole history of various productions, and there seems to be quite an extensive production history of Greek tragedy being performed, staged, adapted, written, and written about. How is there a sense what the audience broadly, whether this is just simply something arcane and sitting in, you know, somewhere up there on in some kind of ivory tower, or something that people actually engage with in a much more, popular. I don't want to use the word popular. I don't really mean popular. In a more public way, in a more public sphere way. Okay, you've gone away again.
Sorry. Always that's a difficult question to answer, but my sense is that although the writers really wanted people to engage with it in this popular way and had intellectual reasons why they thought they should, it was more seen as this kind of ivory tower, sort of distinct culture than really incorporated. I mean, there were lots of people saying you guys really should get into this, but it's unclear really how far that message was taken up. I mean, a lot of the history of the 20th century engagement with Greece is in Egypt. Is people trying to find intellectual justifications for why this should matter.
Okay.
But maybe not ever actually really succeeding. I mean, perhaps you need more than that.
Okay. Okay, well, thank
that's
you.
Very, yeah, that's, that might not be what you wanted to hear, but...
No.
It might not be true as well.
You know, obviously, we need to... I mean, it's... It seems to me that there are these responses. It's very difficult to understand how people are responding unless you're actually in the auditorium with them when they're responding.
And that's only my rough sense. It might be. I mean, other people might have a different sense of that.
I mean, Iman said to me, Egyptian theatre is European theatre. She said to me, in a kind of quite straightforward way. So I don't know whether she's just being provocative or whether she's, there's a sense that there isn't much distinction between what a production of a Greek tragedy would look like in Egypt and what it would look like even today.
I think that's probably fair today.
Whereas...
To a point.
that wouldn't be the case in South Africa, for example, anymore. It would have been the case in the early part of the century, of the 20th century. But from about the 1970s, 1980s onwards, that wouldn't be the case anymore.
And there are theatre troupes in Egypt who are, I mentioned Awasha already because they're sort of the most prominent, but who are really experimenting with non-European forms.
Mm. And by non-European forms, you mean?
What you might call traditional Egyptian, traditional Arabic, sort of, or what one might also call folk, but that's a loaded word. But
I mean, I'm very interested in this epic thing that you raised. I mean, that the possibility that the connection to this is actually epic, that somewhere along the line, the storytelling forms.
Mm.
And these kind of things are across the continent much more, and that where they overlap or reach towards the tragic, they begin to come up. But it's not the tragedy per yeah. se that's the thing.
I wonder, yeah, Hassan al-Gharadli might be a good person to speak to.
Okay. And he's based in Cairo?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No worries.